Ready to begin? Yeah? Okay. So tonight we're going to begin at the beginning of the book. The second book. Second book of the Torah. This is the book in which we become a nation. In the first book of the Torah, Genesis, there's the story of creation. And then creation kind of goes sour. And then it gets fixed and it goes sour again. And it makes the case for the need for some kind of lodestar, some kind of guidance, inspiration, somebody who's going to lead the world to its perfection. And that's how we get introduced to Abraham and Sarah, and they found a family. And the family, it starts off very small. First, there's just one Jewish child, and there's two Jewish children, but one falls off the path. And then we have a family, and we have family feuds and all kinds of issues. And at the end of Genesis, the family settles into a foreign land and makes themselves at home. But after all, this is not who they really are and where they really belong. And the book of Exodus opens by recounting that descent into exilic paradigms. The Elah Shmot B'nai Yisrael, this is the book in which we are born as a nation, the book in which we develop into a people. And it starts by telling us these are the names of the Jewish people, Haboyim Mitzroima, who are coming into Egypt. And obviously, this is a verse that has 1,000 question marks attached to it. Nothing in the Torah is redundant or superfluous. Every word is needed, required, necessary, in fact, critically important if the Torah can convey to us a message by means of characters, not words. It'll do so sometimes through dots, and sometimes through what's proverbially called crowns in the Torah, or empty spaces, or lack of empty spaces. Entire halachas are learnt from the tiniest nuance. And here, the Torah introduces us to a story that we have already read. There's nothing new. There's absolutely nothing being told to us. These are the names of the children of Israel who are coming into Mitzrayim. Yaakov and his family came. Please tell me something I didn't learn yet. What does it mean? And the second big question mark is, it says Haba'im. These are the people that are coming. They're not coming now. They're not coming. We have to guess that this is approximately 70 or 80 years after they came, when we hear about Vayokom Melech Chodosh. Joseph was king for a relatively small amount of time before his father came down. It was only for 9 years. And the famine ended after the first 2 years. Joseph reigned for 80 years. During the course of the 80 years of Joseph's reign, there was no slavery. There was no bondage. Are you kidding? The viceroy was Jewish. They were doing great. Economic boom. They had surplus. They had joy. They had plenty. They even had the freedom to assimilate. And they did. But it was under Joseph's tutelage. So this verse has to be talking to us now, since the actual protagonist of the story, a Melech Chodosh, a new king over Egypt, whose name we don't know, and frankly, we don't really care, and we don't even know if it was really a new king. We have two opinions, whether he was a new king, actually a different person, or he could have been the same king that appointed Joseph Viceroy, who all of a sudden assumed a makeover. He said, never heard of Joseph. Even if he was a new king, he had to have heard of Joseph. So when we say Melech Chodosh, that there is a new king of Mitzrayim, which you find in verse 8, Asher lo yada es Yosef, who does not know Yosef, it doesn't mean he doesn't know him. Rashi says, Asa atzmei ki'ilo lo yada. He makes himself as if he doesn't know him. In Yiddish, there's an expression, Machzach nitwissendik. Never heard of it. You never heard of it? Really? This is the guy who saved your country, turned your country into the economic superpower, uncontested in its time. All the money in the world ends up in the coffers of Egypt, and the government is established as the singular power because everybody ultimately sells everything to the Pharaoh, and he doesn't know who Joseph is. Asatzmei, whether he actually is new or nischadshu gzeresov, or he remade himself and decided to adopt a new approach and have a new attitude towards the Jewish people, he is the protagonist of the story. If you will, the story begins a verse earlier, B'nei Yisrael paru vayishritzu vayirbu vayatzmu, that the Jewish people experienced an extraordinary population boom, and they were doing fantastic. But that was actually what preceded Vayakom Elachadosh. So at any rate, you've got to be talking 80 years into the story. Approximately 70, 80 years into the story. These are the children that are coming into Egypt. So on a literal level, even though it says that they're coming, as if they would have come now when we know that they actually came 80 years ago. So there's a number of simplistic explanations, and I'll share them with you, what we call the chavivusa de milsa, just to create like the full picture. In other words, what I really want to share with you tonight, and give you a new understanding, a new appreciation of these verses, but I don't want to do that without giving you some kind of literal explanation too. So the Da Zakenim, Labale HaTosfos, maintain that when Yosef was alive, the Jewish people did not pay taxes. Everybody wanted to be Jewish. Really, it was a great life. They were living under Joseph's protection. They lived in Joseph's special province, and they were at a tax shelter. But all of a sudden, when Yosef died, the taxes were levied. And as the anti-Semites learned over the ages that the first way to strike at the Jewish people was through the tax man, or through BDS, or through Kristallnacht, or smashing the windows and stores of Jewish people, but ruining the Jewish economy. So the first thing they set out to do was to ruin the economy for the Jewish people. They said they took all our money. They're doing too well. So they began to give them these staggering taxes and jizyas, and their goal was to break the Jewish people financially. And they would break them when they wouldn't have any money left, so then the people would implode and crumble. And therefore the Da Zakenim said, it's Haboyim Mitzrayim. They never really felt they were in Egypt. It's like being in an embassy. They didn't live in the country. They weren't paying taxes. They didn't have responsibilities. They didn't have obligations. They were just enjoying life. And all of a sudden, they said, good morning, you're in Egypt now. We decided you're in the 73% tax bracket. Oh, you have no money? That's no problem. We can garnish your possessions. So that's when they really began to feel the squeeze. It wasn't until that point that they actually felt that they were in Egypt. And that's why it says, Haboyim Mitzrayim, of the first 80 years, very, very easy, like a breeze time in Mitzrayim. Now they felt they were actually coming into the land of Egypt. The Moshe of Zakenim, which is an accompanying teaching, kind of the same genre, only it was published many, many years later from manuscript. There's also Bali HaTosfos from the Tosafos. And the second compilation of commentary in the Chumash from the Bali HaTosfos, he says that the reason we say Haboyim Mitzrayim is to emphasize that the Jewish people up until this point looked exactly the way they did on the day they stepped off the boat. There used to be a terrible expression amongst American and Canadian Jews, especially for refugees that were coming after the war. You know what they used to call them?
Greeners.
Huh? Greeners. Even worse, green echayas. Like a green banana. You know, not ripe. And they made fun of these poor Jews. Jewish people, many of them Holocaust survivors. Some of them from the camps. Some of them Siberia. Some from hiding places in forests. And they came here, and their kind, well-coiffed Western brethren called them green echayas because they couldn't speak English and they didn't really understand the mores of the Western world. And if you speak to people who are like baby boomer, the baby boomer generations, the children of these refugees, a lot of times they felt the lack of tolerance from their acculturated brothers and sisters your parents are greeners and they would maybe dress them funny and they couldn't afford the things that their American or Canadian counterparts had. And they were like, they stepped off the boat. It's an expression. It looks like you stepped off the boat. So the Bali HaTosfos tell us that for the first 80 years of the Jewish people's time in Mitzrayim under Joseph's tutelage, they didn't really assimilate very much. They looked the same way they came. It was as if they stepped off the boat. They were Jews from Canaan, from Israel. They spoke Hebrew. They wore Hebrew clothes. They kept the mores and ethos of their ancestors. It was like they lived physically in Egypt, but mentally, emotionally, spiritually, they never left Eretz Yisrael. But now they did. And at this point, they're Boyim Mitzrayim. These are the names, and they still had the names. They still had the Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda. They were still had the names. But now they started to get into Egyptian life. And things started to shift here, which actually is saying to us that there was like two comings to Egypt. or two descendings into Egypt. First was the actual physical descending when terrestrially they arrived, but they weren't really there. Either the first approach, you weren't paying taxes, life was good, or the second approach, they had maintained their spiritual equilibrium. They didn't change in any way. But then there was that, pardon my expression, second coming. They came into Mitzrayim the second time. And now, as if now they're really going into Mitzrayim. Now the clouds are starting to gather. The sky is getting dark. There's doom and gloom on the horizon. Now they felt as if they were really starting to live in the land of Mitzrayim as foreigners, as strangers, and ultimately as slaves. And that's the simple way we explain this. That's why the Torah opens up by telling us it's actually a very revealing verse. You have to just think about it. You have to contemplate. It's a very revealing verse. It's telling us about the Jewish people's acculturation to Mitzrayim. It didn't happen overnight. And there were two major paradigms or two major periods. There was the first when they first came, and then this Joseph died, the Shvatim died, and they came again. So that's the Haboyim, that's the dynamic Haboyim. And they come, Yaakov comes, and his family comes, and up until this point, up until the opening of Parsha Shemot, they're still just a family. And then they're no longer a family. And then the Bnei Yisrael Poru, Vayishritzu, Vayirbu, Vayatzmu, B'ma'id, Ma'id, six different expressions of prolific procreation, which our sages tell us was indicative of the fact that there were sextuplets being born, and there was an a population boom that is unparalleled. Unparalleled. This has nothing to do really with going into Mitzrayim, but just as a point of interest. Do you know where the highest birth rate ever recorded in the world took place? The highest birth rate ever since they started keeping records. Not from Mitzrayim. You don't know where? In Bergen-Belsen. In Bergen-Belsen, 1946. It's the highest birth rate. Every day another baby was born. Every single couple had a baby. So there's baby boomers, and then there was these survivors who came together. Bergen-Belsen was like a way station on the way to the concentration camps. So a lot of the Jews ended up, many of the marriages happened over there in the weeks that followed. And all they wanted to do was recreate what they lost. Everybody was having babies. That's all they wanted. Was they were like singular about this. All these people Nebuch wanted to do is rebuild something, have something of their own, because everything would be taken from them. So here we don't find the Jewish people in that terrible situation yet, but they want to bring children into the world. It's like there's an unbelievable swarming of a Jewish population which alarms the local monarchy and gets the Egyptians very uncomfortable, and that's what sets into wheel the motions in that's what sets the wheels in motion to unfold what we call Galus Mitzrayim, the bondage of slavery, the suffering of the land of Egypt, the exile of Egypt, which eventually gives way to the Exodus. Okay, shot. Not too hard to understand. Kind of simple. All right, the rest of tonight will be very mystical. And then it will become very practical. So the Alter Rebbe, in his magnum opus of Maimorim, which is known as Torah Ur, although there are thousands of Maimorim from the Alter Rebbe that he delivered over the years, but there was just about 2,000 Maimorim that were selected and refined. And these are the Maimorim that were inducted into the formal books of Hasidic commentary in the Torah portion, which is known as Torah Ur and Lakota Torah. Torah Ur is primarily on the books of Genesis, Bereshis, and on Shmos, and Lakota Torah, it primarily is on the last three books of the Torah, Megillat Esther, and some of the other scriptures, Shir HaShirim. So the Alter Rebbe, he analyzes the beginning of the parsha, but he's not looking for a literal answer, and he asks, Lama Hochvo B'Torah Inyan Boya Mitzrayim? Why does the Torah repeat their coming into Mitzrayim? He knows what the Balei HaTosfos answer. He knows what Ramban answers. But the Alter Rebbe is asking a different kind of question over here. So the Alter Rebbe says, I have to tell you something. The redundancy is evident from the very beginning. It's not just because here it says Haboyim Mitzrayim, and in Parshas Vayigash it says Haboyim Mitzrayim. It's not just that. He says there's a words of the Shvatim, words of the tribes, maybe not even knowing what they're saying, but these words presage the eventual descent into the land of Egypt and the eventual exile, where the Shvatim say to Yosef, who accuses them of nefarious activities, spying, trying to uncover the weakness of the land and exploit what's going on in Egypt. So they said, okay, let's start from the very beginning. Yorad Yoradnu. We came down here. We came down here. And that's redundant. It says Yoroid Yoradnu, which literally would translate as something like coming down, we came down, or came down, we came down. So the Alter Rebbe says that it indicates that there's Yerida Achar Yerida, that there is descent that's followed by another descent. Now, this is not divorced from the literal meaning we talked about. The Egyptian exile actually happened in stages, many, many stages. But there are basically two major stages in the coming into Mitzrayim. In the actual bondage and the slavery itself, we could identify at least three major phases where there was paradigm shifts. Things got successively worse. And then there were quantum leaps forward where things got terribly worse. And then there's that final phase where the Pharaoh has some kind of leprosy, and they told him that the only way he could heal himself is by bathing in the hot blood that's squeezed out of the bodies of babies. So he's slaughtering dozens of babies a day, squeezing their bodies into a bathtub and then bathing in their blood. This is like when it hits rock bottom and the Jewish people are literally on full meltdown. And that's at the exact moment when God says, oh, okay, and now it's time. Moses, you ready to listen? I have a job for you. That's the final, that's the nadir, that's the lowest of all, that's the rock bottom. But there are three successive phases before this. But that's all in what we call the exile and the slavery. In the coming down into Mitzrayim, there are two major theaters of action. There's the coming down, physically, terrestrially, literally, and then there's the second coming down. So the Alter Rebbe points out that when it comes to Geula, when it comes to redemption, we find the same redundancy. We find it says, A'olcha gam olay. I will take them up, and again, I will bring them up. Or, Oloi nala, we will surely go up. But it doesn't say we will surely. It says Oloi nala. Same kind of redundancies. She says this, Beis Aliyas. There seems to be two Yeridais and two Aliyas. Two going down and two going up. Which is an Iloi achar Iloi. It's like you're going up and then you're going up to a whole new level. In Teiras Chaim, which is a similar type of compilation from the Mittler Rebbe, he adds a very important key point in this analysis. And he says that when you talk about the Exodus, or when you talk about the exile, you should endeavor not only to understand it in literal terms, but also to understand it in spiritual terms, and then to personalize those spiritual terms. So there's spiritual concepts, and then you have to find the way it talks to you. What is it saying to me? And that is to say like this. When we study Torah, we know that there are 70 different ways, 70 dimensions of understanding the Torah. One dimension of understanding the Torah would be called, for lack of better terminology, the Kabbalistic or mystical dimension. And the Kabbalistic and mystical dimension will talk about all of the details in Torah in a non-literal fashion. All of these are representations of some kind of cosmic spiritual ideas. The Pharaoh will become a figure in a cosmic spiritual schematic. The concept of slavery becomes a notion, a concept. It doesn't mean that we're heartless. It doesn't mean we don't feel the suffering of people. That's pshat. In the pshat level, that's real. And when we tell the story in the night of Pesach, we're actually supposed to identify with the pain, with the suffering, with the agony, so that we can experience the joy and the elation. But that doesn't mean that the Torah is just a technical story. And it doesn't mean the Torah is even just paradigms or examples, but that ultimately everything is part of this huge spiritual panorama. So in this huge spiritual panorama, every detail of Torah gets translated into spiritual terminology or Kabbalistic terminology. So I want to share with you the Kabbalistic terminology that's used for what we just identified, Beis Yerides and Beis Aliyas, two going down and two coming up. And the Kabbalistic terminology that I'm going to share with you will seem on the surface to have absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with physical Egypt, not geographically, not proverbially. There's no issue or question of suffering or pain or deprivation or forced labor. None of that. This is entirely conceptual. Okay, you ready for this? This is not everyday language. Okay, it's very spiritual language. And My goal tonight is to try to translate this very, very spiritual language into language that you should be able to use in your own life to find freedom. But I'm going to get to that in a minute. What I'm going to quote you now, I'm going to quote you now from the Tzemach Tzedek, and then I'm going to quote you from the Rebbe. This is, the Tzemach Tzedek gives like a synopsis of the spiritual terminology that's employed in us understanding this business of Yaakov and his family coming to Mitzrayim. And this is what he says. I'm going to use the verbiage, the syntax of the Tzemach Tzedek, because he takes some very long ideas and he really puts them into just a few little sentences. So this is the mystical sentence that he creates. He says, Inyan Beis HaYerides, this idea of these two descents, which we've talked about, in what he calls the Bechinas Malchus, and I'll get back to that, but Malchus is the terminology used to describe the lowest of the ten Sefirot, which is called kingship or regality, but perhaps is best understood as responsibility. V'hu al yedei Beis Bechinas Hamshachas. This comes through two drawing forth or bringing down Mebechinas Yaakov. So Yaakov represents something spiritually, and Yaakov has to be drawn down. So the name Yaakov, incidentally, according to the Kabbalists, represents the notion of taking the loftiest ideal and bringing it down into the lowest rung of existence. And that's found in the name. Yaakov is Yud and Ekev. Yud is the smallest letter of the Hebrew alphabet. It represents the highest form of self-suspension. It represents the deepest and most profound kind of transparency where you aren't and you recognize a higher truth, and like as if you're like glass, you know, like it's a tiny, tiny point. There's a tiny particle of existence, but that's it. You're bathed in a higher spiritual consciousness. You're aware of the far greater reality. You're not obsessing over, it's the opposite of narcissism. Okay, there's no self. It's like when self is almost suspended. Self is almost gone. That's Yud. And it goes into Ekev. Ekev in Hebrew is the word that's used to describe the heel. What does the heel represent? Well, let's make it simple. When the chassan breaks the glass under the chuppah, he doesn't do it with his nose. He doesn't do it with his knees. He doesn't do it with his elbows. He doesn't do it with his fist. What does he use? The heel. Why? Because the heel is the part of the body that is most able to sustain the blunt force of smashing something and being just fine about it. He doesn't do it with his toes. The heel is it's the thickest skin, the hardest bone, and that's where you know the body kind of leans on the heel. Without heels, you're in big trouble. It's very hard to walk without heels. So the heel represents what the Gemara calls Malach HaMavis Sheba Adam. The least alive part of a person. The part where there's least life is the heel. The head is the most life. The heel has the least life. So it represents the lowest rung of life, of sensitivity, of existence on a spiritual sense. So Yaakov is Yud and Ekev, represents the highest, loftiest ideal brought into the lowest common denominator, what we would call boots on the ground. So Yaakov has to be drawn down. That's what Yaakov is about. How does Yaakov get drawn down from the world of theory into the world of practice? In theory, Yaakov believed that he should be the progenitor of the Jewish people. That's very nice. It's a nice ideal. Yaakov said, I'm going to be righteous and I'm going to be humble. I'm going to be studious and I'm going to be educated. I'm going to be mindful and I'm going to be committed and all the other beautiful things that Yaakov did. And then his father said to him, that's really nice, but you know, in order, if you plan to be a progenitor of the Jewish people, you'll need to find a wife. Yaakov says, really? I have to find a wife? You mean I have to like get a job and everything? And his father goes, yeah. And you got to do it far away and all by yourself. I'm going to give you some help, but the help doesn't last very long because he gets mugged on the way by his delightful nephew, who actually leaves him for dead by taking all of his money. And then Yaakov is really worried about this encounter. So what does he do? He decides to hide in the yeshiva for 14 years. Okay? He learned his whole life, and it's okay, now is time. Now it's time. Can I just have like 2 minutes? Like my daughter Hannah, like whenever I want to take her out of the bath. Hannah, want to come out of the bath? 2 minutes, 2 minutes. Everything is 2 minutes. Like this is her delaying tactic. Everything is 2 minutes. Ready for your bath? 2 minutes, 2 minutes. Yaakov was like, 2 minutes? And he goes for 14 years to yeshiva. Okay, fine. Now, eventually they kick him out. They say, okay, we need to make room. He says, I'm not even taking up a bed. I don't even have a room in the dorm. He said, we know, but you still need to get out of here. Okay, fine. So Yaakov has no choice. He's got to go. And he's really afraid. And God comes and he gives him this amazing vision. Ufaratzta. He sees the ladder, angels going up and down. That's all great. And now Yaakov has to actually build a family. Okay, so what do you need to build a family?
He needs a wife.
It's all great. It's a beautiful theory, but you need a wife. Okay, so Yaakov gets two wives. He bargained for one, but he got two. Right? And there's a lot to be said about that, but he bargains for one and gets two. And this is how we see it from a perspective of spiritual terminology. There's Leah, and then there is Rachel. So what is the difference between Leah and Rachel besides that they're two different people? What is the difference on a spiritual level? Or what does this mean on a spiritual level that Yaakov has got to get actualized, he's got to get drawn down, and he gets drawn down into Leah and then into Rachel? So skipping a lot of strata. I'm not going to tell you how we get here, but there's copious writings of the Arizal that discuss this in great detail. I'm taking you to the finish line of this thing. The finish line of this thing is as follows. Yaakov represents the highest level of idealism, mental acuity, epiphany, whatever you want to call the beginning of theory. But the theory has to be actualized. In order for the theory to be actualized, in order for you to actually develop an idea, so the idea has to be dressed in language. It has to be couched in some kind of language. You have to take, whether it's a feeling, whether it's an idea of how to solve a problem, whether it's inspiration, you have to, in order to kind of to develop it so that it could be passed on to somebody else, it needs language. Language is the tool. Language is the vehicle through which you can take something that's very deep at the core of our being and convey it outside of ourselves. So assuming that our goal in life is to make a difference in the outside world, not to live in a cocoon, but to transcend that world and to engage, right, to develop relationships, in order to do that, I have to have language to do so. And the language comes on two levels. The first thing I need to do is, I need to think about it. I need to find language that I'm comfortable with in my own mind. We think using a language. Everybody thinks in a language because you need characters, you need letters. But then the way you think about something and the way you actually verbalize something are not one and the same. And that's why sometimes people think about it. They think about it many, many times until they reach the point where they're now ready not just to think about it themselves, but actually to share with somebody else. So the Arizal says that Leah represents machshava, Leah represents the concept of thought, and Rachel represents the concept of dibur. Both employ language, both employ characters, both employ a series of vehicles or mechanisms through which something is conveyed. Now, obviously, alphabet soup is not a profound thing. And eating alphabet soup or eating alphabets is not going to make you smart, even if it's Hebrew alphabets. How come? Because they're just letters. The letters don't have meaning unless they're arranged a certain way. If the letters are put together in words and sentences and compositions, they can convey very profound things. They can be very meaningful. If they're just jumbled together, it's a mechanism, but it's not a mechanism that's been harnessed or utilized or employed. So a person could have a jumble of thoughts without thinking about something clearly. Absolutely nothing was accomplished. You have no clue what you want to do. You have no clue what you want to say. A person could just start to scream alphabets or letters or words. As a rule, he will not be able to convey anything. Will not be meaningful in any way, shape, or form. You need meaningful speech. It requires thought and requires characterization or arrangement of the letters where you're actually going to choose your words carefully and use specific mechanism to be able to convey something from in here so that it gets out there. Any questions so far making sense? Okay. So, Tzemach Tzedek says that you should know, on a spiritual schematic, the concept of these ideas or this descent, this double descent, is that in order for the descent of Mitzrayim to take place fully, so first Yaakov has to marry Leah, and then afterwards he has to marry Rachel. The two descents are taking the idea and putting it first into thought, and then after putting it into thought, then putting it into words, into verbiage, into communication. That's the two descents. Which means that every time you or I decide to think about something, or every time you or I decide to speak about something, we just put ourselves in Mitzrayim. That's what it means. Because Mitzrayim, going down into Mitzrayim, is metaphorized with the terminology of Yaakov marrying Leah and Yaakov marrying Rachel, or taking the idea and thinking about it, taking the idea and articulating it, speaking about it, whether it's that's in writing or in words that are spoken. In other words, that's the concept of Mitzrayim. That's the concept of exile. And that does not seem to make much sense at all. Exile is a terrible thing, and talking things out is great. Thinking things through, very healthy. So the Alter Rebbe kind of asks this question. He says, I don't understand this. He says, if you're telling me that this whole business of the double descent is the idea of taking something from the way it is inside my own reality and putting it into words that are thought or spoken, and that's the spiritual equivalent of Golus Mitzrayim, what exactly does that mean? If I convey a thought to you, did I just put myself in Egypt? did I inhibit myself? Did I shackle myself? Or did I express myself and I feel free? You ever have a secret that you want to tell somebody? And you? The Friedrich Rebbe once said, there's three kinds of balsod. There's three kinds of people who keep a secret. One doesn't really keep the secret. That's like most people, you know. They kind of give little hints. The other one does not breathe a word, but everybody knows he has a secret. And the third one is the one nobody even knows he has a secret. He said, that's the real balsod. The real balsod, the real secretive person, is he can carry it inside and nobody even knows he has a secret. Okay. So, which would be harder to do? To keep the secrets inside? Which would feel freer? Or where would you feel more shackled? If you have this amazing information, but you can't share it, you can't talk about it? Or if you can say whatever you want, feel free to speak. Or think freely, speak freely, it won't be held against you. Which is a paradigm of freedom? I'm gonna bet that 99 out of 100 people will tell you that the ability to speak and articulate and think freely is what freedom is about. That if somebody says, no, you can't think about that. You're not allowed to think, what do you mean I'm not thinking about that? You mean a thought police? Can't talk about it. Politically incorrect. You're not allowed to. We can arrest you for saying that. Oh, really? Wow. Okay, welcome to Mitzrayim. That's what it would feel like. If I can speak about it. And here we have Hasidic terminology talking to us about the notion of speaking being a form of exile, or of thinking being a form of exile. The Rebbe asks the question a little bit differently, a little more refined. He says, all of existence comes through what we're going to call a chain of descent. Everything has a domino effect. Somebody says something somewhere, and one thing leads to the next. Have you heard the butterfly effect? I'm serious. This is a theory that's actually proven. A butterfly flaps his wings in China, and there's a clap of thunder in Thornhill. Because everything has an effect. On some level, this is called Hishtalshelus. Hishtalshelus comes in the term of Shalshelet. What does Shalshelet mean? A chain. And that's what we call it, a chain of events. You could think of the dominoes. You know, they have these Guinness World Book of Records. They have like 75,000 dominoes all lined up, and you watch them keep going. You know, like, one thing, everything has a ripple effect. Everything has an effect. And each effect causes the next effect. So there's a cause and effect, a constant cause and effect. There's random cause and effect, and then there's choreographed cause and effect. Random cause and effect means there is no creator, there is no kind of order to things. It's whatever, stuff just happens. scientifically speaking, it makes sense that stuff just happens because it's impossible for us to conceive of everything happening in concert. It's impossible to conceive of that. But at the same time, scientifically speaking, when you know how perfect the ecosystem is, and you know how exquisite the solar system is, to say that any of that is an accident or random is also a ridiculous thing. It's like when you realize how much has to go right for existence to be as we know it, and then to say that happened by accident, that's what you call a leap of faith, or a leap away from faith. But it's not logical. It's not something which doesn't fit into rhyme and reason. If you would tell anybody who claims that the world randomly came into existence, that the table put itself together, all these tables, in fact, put themselves together by accident, and they all happen to use exactly the same dimensions, but it's an accident, or that the books put themselves together, or that the writing put itself together, or that the iPhone put itself together, nobody would believe you, for good reason, because that's statistically impossible. And yet the world is infinitely more sophisticated, and people will tell you that it happened by mistake. So, we can't conceive of all these things interacting and interfacing, but on the other hand, we can't conceive of everything being random either. So we, people of faith, say there is a God who is beyond our fathomability, and ultimately everything is choreographed. All right. So if everything is choreographed in the material sense, it's much more sophisticated on the spiritual side. There's a chain of descent involving myriads of levels, and one level has a ripple effect and begets the next level. We have a broad idea of this. It's called knowing Seder Ishtashlos. The Arizal says it's a mitzvah ram of anasa to know the Seder Ishtashlos, to know the order of the worlds and how each world engenders the next world and what comes where and how, what causes what, although you can't look at it under a microscope and you can't prove it. But we can say that the human being or the human personality is patterned after Seder Ishtashlos. So the Rebbe's question about this is, the business of ideas being brought into thought, into Olam HaMachshava, and then from Olam HaMachshava being brought into Olam HaDibur, that is Hishtalshalus. That's how God creates the world. Just like it's how you do something. You're sitting in the room, and you're suddenly cold. So what do you do? Your mind starts to work. You start to think about this. First, you have the sensation that you're cold. The sensation that you're cold doesn't have a cold attached to it or a kufresh attached to it. It's not kar or cold. It's a sensation. It's an awareness. A baby is aware of things before it has any ability to articulate itself or has any ability of language. So the baby is aware. You're aware of something. But the moment you're aware of something, what do you start to think of? If it's something which is comfortable, I'd like more of this. Something which is uncomfortable, I need to end this. How do I stop it? How do I stop it? So if I take my baby, this morning I took her out of the car and it was cold, the wind blew, what did she say right away? She said, it's cold. And what did she do next? She took her hood and she pulled her hood over her head because she's cold. So she's thinking. She's old enough to know that if it's cold, this is going to keep me warm. That's called thinking. Now, there are more sophisticated ways of thinking, but the point is you have a sensation, you're aware of something, and then you start to think. So you process, you think, it's cold. Why am I cold? I wasn't cold before. Ah, there's a window that's open. The window that's open outside, it's cold. So you have the idea that, you know, if the window's open, I need to get it closed. Hello, can you close the window? Sensation to thought to speech, somebody closed the window. Now you think you're warm. Maybe you will be warm eventually. But what I'm trying to say is that nothing happens by itself, and everything has a pecking order. You have to think about things before you talk about them. You have to talk about things before you act on them. You can't expect people to do things if you never told them what you want them to do. You can't expect to be able to speak about something cogently if you never thought about it. So if somebody asks you a question that you know nothing about, so what do you plan to do about this? They say, I don't even know this was a thing. Well, what do you say about it? I don't know what to say about it. I don't know anything about it. So give me a chance to think about this, and then I'll tell you what I say about it, and then maybe I'll figure out what to do about it. That's called Seder Ishtashlos. So the Rebbe says, all of the spiritual worlds necessarily follow Seder Ishtashlos. In Seder Ishtashlos, there's the essence. The essence has to come into thought, and thought has to come into speech, and then speech comes into action. How did that become Mitzrayim? Well, we needed to go to Mitzrayim in order for us to exist? Like, what does that mean? This is the question. So just to retrace our steps, we had this double descent. We gave you a little answer. The deeper answer sounds very mystical using Kabbalistic jargon. But in the end, when you think about the mystical answer, it does not seem to make any sense whatsoever in our world. So how do we work this out? As a little bit of a preface, before I go further, I want to share with you the contents of a letter that the Rebbe once penned. It's a letter about freedom. It's a letter that the Rebbe penned several, I think, days, maybe weeks before Pesach. The theme, of course, of Pesach is
freedom.
Zman Chirusenu, the time of our liberty or freedom. And many people will tell you that they feel like slaves before Pesach, when they're cleaning and cooking and preparing, and they don't feel free at all. And then they'll tell you, this is freedom? And says, yeah, this is freedom. Ein lucha ben chayrin, ela misha isa b'teira. Nobody's free unless he or she learns Torah. And says, you got to be kidding. When somebody throws off the yoke of Torah and mitzvahs, what are they called in Yiddish? There's a name for it.
Afikoros.
Afikoros is an attitude, it's a mental approach, it's a perspective. Not everybody has perspective. Turn that off. not everybody is so philosophical. They say, why did you eat that? I said, because it's good. Because it tastes good. Why did you go there? Because it was fun. You don't believe in God? I do. So why did you do that? Because I don't think God really cares that much anyway. And anyway, it was a lot of fun. I was tempted. I gave in to the temptation. Now, Epicurus is a person who comes to this, you know, deep-seated intellectual conclusion that there isn't a God or something like that. You have to know quite a bit to be an Epicurus. But a person who isn't following, you know, today they call it OTD, off the derech. But if somebody was on a derech, and then he's off a derech. What do we call it in Yiddish? He has expression in Yiddish. He's called frei.
Frei.
Frei means in Yiddish free. It's free. It's free. This person has to eat this and not eat that and go here. And this person, I do whatever I want. I don't eat when I want, where I want, what I want, how I want. No limitations. Religious limitations, restrictions, not for me. I'm free of that. So here you have the Gemara saying, "In lecho ben chayre lemisha isk b'tayre." You want to be free? You need to get involved in Yiddishkeit. And here you have a person saying, "You got to be kidding! This is the most restricting and inhibiting faith system on the face of earth." Well, the faith system is about love, and that's it. Okay, fine, love to be able to—it regulates every detail of life. So the Rebbe says, "Let's talk about freedom." Freedom is a relative term. The original theory of relativity is not about the movement of light or noise. The original theory of relativity is in studying people or things and freedom. And the Rebbe says, the world, broadly speaking, is divided into four levels. Domim, tzomeach, chai, medaber. Domim means the inanimate. Tzomeach means the vegetative. Chai is the animal world. Medaber is a human being. Now, this is very broad terminology because everything from water to minerals to rocks to gas, it's all domim, it's all inanimate. It doesn't grow, it is what it is. Whether it's oxygen or a rock, it just is. These are things that are. Now, of course, with quantum physics, you know that nothing just is and nothing is really stationary, but it certainly seems to the naked eye to be so. So that incorporates everything in the mineral world, everything in what we would call the static world. And then there's a world of vegetation, which incorporates everything from shrubs or from algae to redwood trees. Enormous objects, tiny objects. Hatzad hashava shebinehem, the common denominator is they're all growing, provided that they're still connected to the source from where they get nourishment. If the tree is still rooted in the ground, it can still be growing. If the shrub or the moss is still connected to the rock, it can still be growing. If the algae is in a place that actually supports its life and it can develop, it can still be growing. What happens if it loses its source of life?
It withers.
It withers. Can't grow anymore. So if you could talk to a tree or a potato or a tomato, and you say, what would you like? What would you like to be able to do? What would it tell you? I would like to be able to pull myself out of the ground and go for a walk. This has to be crazy. A crazy tree does that. No tree does that. What does the tree want? The tree wants to spread its roots. That's all the tree wants. Don't get in my way. Allow me to spread my roots deeper and deeper and deeper. If you chop its roots, or if it comes into some kind of obstacle, you're inhibiting the tree. All the tree wants to do is spread its roots. Now, the deeper its roots spread, the harder it is to move it. It's going to be sometimes almost impossible. Some of these roots can go out 30, 40, 50 feet in the ground. Can't get the roots out of the ground. So for a tree, freedom is to be in one place. And the stronger it can express itself, the deeper it can sink its roots, the freer it is. That's in the world of vegetation. In the animal world, that's teeming with life. So what does life seek? Life seeks to be untethered. The animals don't want to be in a cage. The animals want to be free. The bull wants to be free. The fish wants to be free. The bird wants to be free. If you inhibit them, if you say you have to be in this particular space, then it's called captivity. The bird in captivity can't go wherever it wants. They tell a story that there was two camels in the Toronto Zoo, a mother camel and a child camel, and the little baby camel says, Mama camel, why do we have such wide feet? And the mama camel says, baby camel, because we're built to walk in the desert and it's very hot sand and the wide feet help us to... And he says, that's very interesting. Why do we have these crazy humps? And the mama camel says, that's because we have go for long distances in arid areas and we need to be able to store a lot of water, a lot of hydration. And he says, and why do we have these strange necks that come like cranes? Well, because we live in places that it's hard to get to the vegetation and the camel has to reach out. And the little camel says, so what are we doing to Toronto Zoo? These animals are in captivity. They're not free. And these animals actually wither. There was an experiment done where they released animals from captivity into freedom. And many experiments like this. But in one of the experiments, the animals withered. They couldn't survive. They had lost their survival ability. After years and years in captivity, they didn't know what it meant to hunt for food anymore. They didn't know what it meant to forage for themselves. Everything was just given to them. So that's an animal in captivity. Whether animals are happy being in zoos or not, I don't know, and I don't purport to be an expert in that. But I'm not sure if the fish are happier to live in SeaWorld and get fed endless amounts of tuna, or they would rather be in the deep sea looking for the food. I don't know. And I'm not opining on whether SeaWorld is a good place or a bad place. I'm just talking about the idea of freedom for an animal is to be able to go wherever you please. That's all animal. That works for an animal, right? So the freedom for a tree and the freedom for a creature, a living creature, are really worlds apart. Okay, let's talk about people. Suppose a person has the ability to go wherever he or she wants, wherever you want, but you cannot speak your mind, and you cannot think, and you have no right to relationships, and you cannot have any kind of profundity to life. You can just go wherever you want. You want to swim, swim. You want to fly, go fly. You want to walk, walk, run, do whatever you want. No limitations where you can go. All limitations are restricted to what we would call the higher form of life. Restrictions are the restrictions on emotions, restrictions on the intellect, restrictions on what we will call civilization. You're not allowed to speak to anybody. You speak to anybody, we shoot you. You can go wherever you want, but you can't open your mouth. How free would that person be? Not free at all. So what was very free for a bull is not free for a person. There was a famous American revolutionary who said, before the British hung him, his name was Patrick Henry, and he said, what's your last words? And he gave a sermon before they kicked over the stool. He said, give me liberty or give me death. Because Patrick Henry was saying that if I cannot express myself freely, I'm not interested in life. I don't want to live like a bull. I don't want to live like an animal. Now, obviously, a person would not like to be locked up in a little kennel either, in a little cage. And obviously, a person would not like to be planted in the ground and not be able to move. That goes without saying. But the freedom of movement is not suffice for a description of freedom. Now, suppose a person would be allowed to move freely, freedom of movement. He can go to the ballet, or he can watch Saturday Night Live, whatever he chooses as culture. He can listen to whatever music he wants, but he is not allowed any kind of spiritual expression. Not allowed to believe. He's not allowed to express his faith. Is that freedom? I once had a conversation with our former Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, after he opened the Office of Religious Freedom, which was a very bold move that unfortunately was shut down by the subsequent Prime Minister. And I happened to be at this event. It was in a mosque called the Ahmadiyya Mosque. And I met with him afterwards, and we talked about a number of things. And he said to me, in every society, he says, if freedom of religion is lost, all freedoms will be lost. He said, freedom of religion is the first freedom to go, and it is the most foundational one. If people cannot have the freedom to enjoy or pursue a relationship with their Creator as they wish to and as they deem to or seem fit, he says, all other freedoms are on the chopping block. And he says, look at communism. The first thing it took away was the freedom of faith. They outlawed faith, and all the other freedoms eventually went. Supposedly, it was going to make everybody very free. Everybody's going to be equal. Everybody's going to be doing the same things. Everybody's going to have everything everybody had. We'll all be equal. And it was not equal. The corruption was worse than with an open market system, and there's no freedom at all. So when we talk about freedom, what are we really talking about? The deepest level of freedom is what? Spiritual freedom. That really is the deepest level. So suppose I'm going to tell you that in order for a person to experience true spiritual freedom, they first have to go to Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim is not an accident. Well, okay, put you in Mitzrayim. In order to experience real spiritual freedom, you first have to go through Mitzrayim, because Mitzrayim is the paradigm of how a nation is born, how a neshama is expressed, how we receive the Torah, and ultimately how Mashiach comes. It's all about this exile and exodus. Exile, exodus. An exile, exodus paradigm. In order, we couldn't get to Matan Torah without first Golus Mitzrayim. That's the way God designed it. Now, this doesn't mean we advocate suffering, and we've done plenty of that already. So, Chas v'Shalom, but we're not talking about this on a literal level. That is an example in a very graphic way, but on a loftier way, when we talk about the concept of freedom, in other words, to be able to tap into our deepest subconsciousness, what do we need to do? How do you get to the subconsciousness? Let me put it this way. How are heroes created? You know, they're heroes. People who do extraordinary things. How are heroes created?
Challenges.
Extraordinary challenges. Heroism only comes in the face of extraordinary challenges. People who are unchallenged will never become heroic. Why not? Why should they? There was no need for heroism. Heroism was the response to a circumstance where you were either going to be a hero or you weren't going to get this. But what if I have it without any heroism? So the hero leaped into a burning building and saved the child. He's a hero. He's a hero. He is a hero. He did something amazing. He revealed from within himself the potential to forget about your own welfare entirely and think about somebody else. And not every heroic story ends well. It's a tragic story in Israel last week. The man went to save a baby, never paid his life. But he's a real hero. That's like an amazing thing. Here's a person who thought not of himself, but of the pain of a child and the child's parents. And he didn't want to die. But so he was always a hero, but you never would have known it. Unfortunately, he's not a hero who lived to tell the tale. There are heroes, many heroes who do live to tell the tale. And that's our idealism. Not chas v'shalom to die. We don't believe in death. We believe in life. But heroism is what's born out of a tremendous need. The reason that the hero is a hero is because there was no other way for the circumstances to work themselves out. So you have to be a hero. What we call, you know, the heroes of yesteryear and of the Hasidic movement, of people who in communist Russia fought communism, and many of them paid with their lives. But because of their sacrifice, that's what we're here today. These were heroic people. They did heroic things because there was no choice. It was do or die. Either you were going to be a hero or you weren't going to be. And if you would be physically, you wouldn't be spiritually, which was not an option. So in the same way you understand that heroism, in order for heroism to reveal itself, and every hero had to be a hero, he couldn't become a hero. What, he got a download all of a sudden? The hero didn't become a hero later on. He was always a potential hero. Really, every one of us is a potential hero. But how do you become a hero when you're faced with those circumstances? I have to tell you, not everybody who's faced those circumstances becomes a hero. Some just become a black hole. Some people just cave in. They collapse. But the heroes only became heroes because of those circumstances. The last maimer from the Rebbe, the Rebbe's maimer Vata Tetzaveh, is all about stimulating heroism when there's no actual external force demanding it of you. Living with heroism, living with absolute self-abnegation, with total commitment above and beyond, when nobody's actually demanding it of you. And the Rebbe maintains that's the highest form of spiritual freedom. And he believed that was the challenge of our generation, to live in the era of two-car garages and wall-to-wall carpeting, to have everything we could possibly want, and yet to live a heroic life Jewishly. So what are the heroics? The heroics are to be a Yid who's doing what Hashem wants him to do, even though it's not the natural path, or the easiest path. It's the greater path of resistance. And if you go against that resistance, you become a hero. So it doesn't require suffering. And if it's external, then the heroism is stimulated. The heroism is created by an external force. But if you self-motivate, then you can be heroic in a much truer fashion, because it's not an external force or duress that's bringing forth your heroism. You yourself have cultivated the heroism from within. And That's the most lasting, and that's the truest form of heroism. But here's the point. When we talk about Mitzrayim and the paradigm of exile and Exodus, when we talk about heroism, when we talk about revealing our potential, which, by the way, is the meaning of real freedom, to reveal the powers that are you, to be all you can be, as the Marines like to say. How do you become all you can be? So there has to be some kind of pattern of exodus, of exile, which leads into exodus. And this is basically the verbiage of that Chassidus is giving us.
So, Rabbi, a quick question.
Yes.
You were talking about random cause and effect. Choreographed cause and effect is also a third, that is non-random, unchoreographed cause and effect. That is situational. And an example of that is if a person has, let's say, a liposarcoma type of cancer, and they're given a certain kind of chemotherapy, what happens is that it eradicates almost the entire cancer. However, if one stem cell is resistant, that stem cell develops a subpopulation. Now, in the case of the subconscious, we know that Abraham was told, he learned that Mitzrayim was going to happen.
Professor, could I interrupt you? And could we do this?
Good question. Mitzrayim was going to happen 400 years later.
Yeah.
This was choreographed cause and effect. But how come there was no oral transmission of that knowledge so that the Jewish people could not avoid that horrendous tragedy? Does it leave us with the question, there were some choreographed causes and effects that cannot be changed by the actions of the Jewish people, no matter what they do?
I think this is what you're saying. Tell me if this is what you're saying, and I'll try to respond to it. I think what you're trying to say to me is, there are things which are choreographed in which there's no freedom of choice. This is the way it's going to be. A begets B, begets C, begets Z. That's the domino, right? And then there are things which are random. Not stuff's happening. And what you're saying is, isn't there a third possibility in which we're set up in a certain situation and we could choose wrong, and sometimes we do choose wrong, so we cause the next disaster, we cause the next domino to fall, but really and truly, we were kind of set up to do it, because if we wouldn't have had those opportunities, if we wouldn't have the craving and the lust, we wouldn't have done the wrong thing to begin with, but the fact is we chose to do the wrong thing. Is that kind of what you're asking?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a very deep and nuanced idea. The Rebbe says that every sin is destined to happen, but you'll still be responsible for what you did. In other words, nothing in the world can happen that God doesn't want it to happen, but that doesn't exonerate you from making the wrong decision. It also, at the same time, means that you have to look at the situation and say, now that I'm in this, how do I figure out how to get out of it? In other words, like this, the Alter Rebbe says, if you get angry, it's like worshiping an idol. Why? Because if you get angry, you're saying, how did you do that to me? But the Alter Rebbe says, what are you talking about? Everything comes from a higher place. Don't you believe Al HaNizik Nigzer, on the one who was damaged, the damage was already decreed? So the answer is yes. The one who sustained the damage, has to know the damage would have come anyway. You who chose to damage, you will have to answer for that. And you will have to deal with it. Does that kind of help?
Yeah.
Okay. So here's the point that we're getting to. First of all, the good news. You don't have to go to Mitzrayim. You don't have to suffer in order to be a good Jew. The notion that we can only be good Jews if we suffer, or we can only be good Jews if there's anti-Semitism, and we can only be good Jews if the world rejects us and hates us, and that's when we're going to be good Jews, we reject that. That's not true. Chas v'shalom. But there is a paradigm of exile that leads to exodus. In other words, there is a paradigm through which a person can self-challenge or put himself in a proverbial Mitzrayim without the blood and the pain and the suffering, but limit themselves, but that limitation leads to a release or to a freedom. And this is the language that the Arizal is using. And this is what Chassidus talks about. I mean, the Rebbe puts it this way. He says, Yerida into Golos is described with Oisiyos. Otiyot are letters, characters. So there's a part of the character that's self-expression. Without thinking, without speaking, I can't self-express. The Alter Rebbe asks this question in Torah Ur, and he says, isn't it necessary for a person to be able to speak, to express himself? So he says, yes, that's true. But there is a level of limitation from the letters. The letters, the characters, which are expressing what you want them to express, also to some degree limit your expression. In different words, sometimes a person will say, I don't have the right words to express myself. So you say, well, find some words. And you'll find words, but the words didn't really do justice to the sentiment, because it was something that was bigger than those words. Or sometimes even being forced to put it into words means that I'm necessarily sacrificing a part of the message because I was forced to put it into words. Like, I wish you would understand me. It's like every fight, every husband and wife. Don't you understand what I'm saying? Oh, cool to say, why don't you tell me? If I have to tell it to you, then already you're not going to understand it. That's true. Tell the story of this couple of guys poking under the bed. And she says, what are you looking for? He says, whatchamacallit? She says, it's in the closet. At a certain point, you don't need the words anymore. So to some degree, the words, they limit. As much as they reveal, words limit. Because they're somebody else's words. Because it's the same, you know, Hallmark's words are very expressive, but they really aren't. Because whether you give your loved one credit for choosing a nice card. I said, but why should I write it myself? Hallmark does it much better. Yeah, but it's not real. Oh, when you Google a nice expression, and you Google right over something else somebody said, it's poetic, but it's not you. And what your loved one really wants is that you should express yourself. So you need to express yourself. You need to find the words. But the words are limiting. That's true. So the Alter Rebbe says the element of Isisena later, you know. And this is the way the Rebbe puts it. The Rebbe says that in every circumstance where there is what's called koyach and poil, koyach is force, let's call it energy, a velocity, and then there's the possibility of something being done. So I have the possibility, for example, I can have the possibility to paint a picture or to draw something or to write something. I have that possibility. It's in me. And then there's the way that possibility comes out. And sometimes it's possible for there to be a disconnect between that which gets done and that which was possible, because I'm doing it. Because once you're putting it into words, because once you're doing it, you're using a certain limitation. And so there's a part of whatever you're trying to bring forth that actually doesn't make it out because of the words. Do you understand what I'm saying? Words reveal and conceal. So the Rebbe asks the question, how then do we get to the deeper form of revelation? Even for yourself, how do you reach into the deepest recesses? How do you set free the deepest sentiments? And the answer is that exodus only comes first through the exile of being forced into communication, into words, into thoughts. Let me put it to you this way. Did you ever have a situation where you didn't have clarity about something, and even when you tried to think about it, you still didn't have clarity, so you sat there with somebody to talk it through, and when you finished talking it through, you knew what you needed to know. But the person you were talking to didn't actually give you the answer. In fact, the person you were talking to maybe doesn't even know the answer, but you know the answer. You got to that answer because you talked it through. Does this make sense? It happens to me all the time. A lot of times when I'm trying to understand something very profound, I'll call one of my colleagues, if there's a senior colleague, and I'll talk it through. And even if they didn't give me the answer, the talking the subject through will help me reach into my own inner rhythm to have a better understanding of it. And this is the paradigm of Mitzrayim. The paradigm of Mitzrayim is that by limiting the deepest freedom, you want to really be free? You want to realize your full potential? That's what we as human beings really want to do. This is what Abraham Maslow called self-actualization. Self-actualize. Right? It's the highest form of life is self-actualization. If you're capable of doing extraordinary things and you're doing menial things, you're not self-actualizing. You may be existing very well. Your biological needs may be met. You're warm, you're sheltered, you have all, you know, the bottom of your pyramid is in place. But the question is, do you ever get to the pinnacle? Do you ever actually self-actualize? And the only way to get to self-actualization is to climb the pyramid. That's what Maslow will tell you. If you're starving and hungry and unhappy, how are you going to be able to get to the pyramid? And of course, Viktor Frankl would argue that that's not really true, that people, as long as they have meaning, they have self-actualization. And he will say he was in the camps and people didn't have anything and they still had meaning in life. So you don't actually need to get, you don't have to climb the pyramid to get to self-actualization. But here's the point I want to make. Really and truly, freedom, real freedom, means to be able to self-actualize. If you're a bird and you have wings and your birds and your wings are clipped, you cannot experience freedom. Because for you as a bird, freedom means to soar the skies. And if you can't spread your wings, then you can't self-actualize. You can't be yourself. You're an eagle. You can't fly like an eagle. If you're a person who is highly intellectual and needs to think and needs to be challenged intellectually, but you don't have anybody to talk to and you don't even have anything that challenges you, you're never going to be happy. You're never going to be freeing who you are. You're always going to feel shackled. You feel like stuck somewhere. If you're a person who needs interaction, who needs friends, you're a gregarious, outgoing kind of person, and you can't find friends, you can't find people you can relate to, you're not going to be able to say, I'm free. I'm not free to express myself. I need somebody to talk to. I need a good friend. I have nobody. I'm here alone. So in order for one to reach the highest form of freedom, in order for you to dig the deepest into yourself to uncover your own subconsciousness, the answer is you have to go to Mitzrayim. You have to go into exile in order to get to Exodus. That means thinking about it and even talking about it. But thinking about it is limiting because now I'm putting it into words. Now I'm putting it into frames. Talking about it seems to be even a greater form of limitation. Yorad Yoradnu. We have to go into Egypt twice. It's not enough to think about it. You actually also have to talk about it. When you think it through, and you talk it through, you can free the idea. The idea that's trapped inside can only be freed when it's limited by the, if you will, the frame of expression, the limitation of expression. And that is the deeper message that we're talking about over here. And that's the idea of going into Mitzrayim. So, like I said earlier, the goodness is we don't have to suffer. We don't have to be in pain. We don't have to self-flagellate. We don't have to be tortured. What we need to do is push ourselves to express that which might be inside in order, even though that expression seems somewhat limiting, but when that limited expression is utilized fully and appropriately, it enables us to set free the deepest sentiments and the deepest idea that are locked up or buried deep within. And that's a little about Exodus. Exile and Exodus made real. Yes? No?
Thank you.
I think it's kind of profound, no?
Very deep.
You have to think about it.
Have to think about
and then talk about it.